This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Today's world spins in the digital domain, and Wired magazine is at the forefront of covering it. Wired reveals the most surprising and resonant stories about the people, companies, technologies, and ideas that are transforming our lives. Wired is on the front lines of the 21st century and keeping you up to date. Coming up next, only on your audio reading service.
Welcome, this is Wired, and I'm your reader, Sam Cantrell, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today we'll be reading from the September-October issue of Wired magazine and some selections from the online edition. They are all copyright 2025 by Condé Nast. And now we'll begin with Beyond Wellness, How Trump Crushed Cancer Research by Alyssa Mule and Anthony Lydgate. When Donald Trump moved back into the White House, the United States was years into its cancer moonshot, a multi-billion dollar Democratic effort to halve cancer deaths by 2047. There was a kind of stalemate. New cases of the disease were emerging about as often as before. Deaths were ticking steadily lower. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration was approving new treatments, if not quite as quickly as anyone wanted. But the taps of federal funding were open as never before, from the Department of Defense to the Environmental Protection Agency to the largest funder of cancer research in the world, the National Institutes of Health. But then Trump decided that American science research was somehow too woke. He paused NIH grant-making for more than 2 months, holding up an estimated $1.5 billion in funding. He effectively halted clinical trials of new drugs. He laid off thousands of employees at the FDA, the NIH, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. At the Department of Veterans Affairs, an estimated $35 million in already funded research, including for cancer, was thrown into jeopardy when Trump instituted a hiring freeze. At the EPA, staff were instructed to cancel existing grants, including to the Health Effects Institute, which was published research on the link between air pollution and cancer. And in the stopgap funding measure set to expire in September, Republicans cut about 60% from the Defense Department's congressionally directed medical research programs, including funding for research on breast and ovarian cancers. The programs for pancreatic, kidney, and lung cancer disappeared from the agency list of funded projects and rolled under another program which did not receive any additional funding for 2025. At the National Institutes of Health, some grants resumed and others were slated for termination. The current state of U.S. cancer research could fairly be described as confusion. While researchers across the country have lost grants, two of the Trump administration's political targets, Columbia and Harvard, have been hit especially hard. And across the board, many of these grant terminations appear to be part of the administration's anti-DEI, anti-trans, and anti-vaccine agendas. Trump officials reportedly maintain a list of flagged keywords that they believe should trigger program reviews. In the NIH grant termination so far, the 50 most common flagged words include trans, expression, diverse, and women. The cruelest cuts, institutions with terminated NIH cancer research grants. The diagram shows a pie chart with 58% going to Harvard Medical School, 28% going to Harvard School of Public Health, 15% going to Harvard University, 13% going to Columbia University Health Services, 5% University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, 4% at Emory University, and also 4% at UC Davis, University of California at Davis, sorry, and the rest, they're a long list down at 1 and 2%. But there's more on the chopping block. Trump wants to defund the National Cancer Institute's below 2014 levels. He wants to refocus the CDC on infectious disease surveillance and shut down duplicative DEI or simply unnecessary programs, which would include the National Center for Chronic Diseases Prevention and Health Promotion and the National Center for Environmental Health. Of course, Trump may not get exactly the budget he wants. Federal judges may keep ordering the grants and programs he has terminated to be reinstated, and maybe he'll even comply. But a court order can't reinstate months of lost treatment for a cancer patient, can't bring back researchers and civil servants who were forced to move on. It's hard to put a price on the value of research that might be years away from a new drug or treatment modality. It's even harder for those who have been kicked out of clinical trials in the past few months, where the stakes are clearly life or death. The moonshot might have lost its chance to land. And now, auto overhaul. Ford's answer to China, a completely new way of making cars. The American automaker is spending billions on a radical reinvention of EV manufacturing, aimed squarely at taking on Chinese competition and Tesla. By Jeremy White, posted 8/11/25 at 11 a.m. I first thought Ford CEO Jim Farley was briefing me on a new car. It turned out to be something altogether more ambitious, a completely new way to make a car, or more precisely, electric vehicles. We build the whole middle, front, and rear separately, and then at the end we put them together, says Farley. No one's ever built a car that way. The approach stands in stark contrast to the usual way cars are made, pieced together bit by bit on a linear production line, one at a time, with engineers contorting themselves into tight spaces, workstation after workstation. Splitting the EV into three complete parts is a potential game changer in terms of both speed and cost. In Ford's new system, an assembly line becomes an assembly tree, where instead of one long conveyor, three sub-assemblies run their own lines simultaneously, then join together. Because you have three smaller sections rather than an entire car to work on, it's possible to make large single-piece aluminum unicastings, each for the front, middle, and rear, replacing dozens of smaller parts. Why do you want to build a car that way? Because the operator can build the car inside the car, says Farley. That's not how it works today. You have all these armatures and things to put in, like instrument panels. Plus, there's no need for line-side parts, right? The parts go into the car as it's being built. Ford calls this new way of making EVs the Ford Universal EV Production System and will spend $2 billion to set it up at the country's Louisville assembly plant. Ford says the new method will be 40% faster than the existing process there and will be comparable reduction in workstations. Parts needed to make Ford's new EVs will be cut by 20%. It has 30% less fasteners, said Farley, referring to the bolts, nuts, screws, rivets, clips, and clamps used to put vehicles together securely. The wiring harness in a coming mid-sized truck will be nearly a mile, 1.3 kilometers, shorter and 10 kilograms lighter. The savings go on. A new way of making cars necessitates new car designs. That's where the Ford Universal EV platform comes in. A brand new 400-volt architecture that uses this Duplo-style three-part assembly. The scalable modular system can be adapted to make a variety of EV shapes and sizes, from B-segment cars to vans and three-row SUVs. And the midsection will use Ford-made lithium iron phosphate LFP prismatic batteries that are cheaper and safer as the structural vehicle floor. The LFP battery, the kind favored in China, is 30% cheaper than a lithium battery. The first vehicle from the Ford Universal EV platform will come in 2027, a mid-size four-door electric pickup with an impressively low targeted starting price of $30,000. Ford says it will be as fast as a Mustang EcoBoost and have more passenger space than the current Toyota RAV4. Doug Field, Ford's chief EV, digital, and design officer, who formerly ran Apple's car program and led to the development of the Model 3 at Tesla, has been marshaling Ford's in-house Skunkworks team, secretly developing this project. "We build a structural battery out of the cells, and that is the floor of the vehicle. So we actually built the seats on it," says Field. "So to be clear, there's no frame or structure with a battery on top of it to which the seats are bolted. With Ford's new model, the battery is the structure. How does this differ from existing cell-to-chassis or cell-to-pack technologies? This is cell-to-body," says Field, adding that making this all work was very, very hard. "There's no single magic breakthrough. It's really, really hard engineering," he says. "And there's a whole bunch of problems to be solved. Like, now you have this body that has no floor. How do you keep it from bending as it goes down the line? How do you deal with the paint when you've painted the back half but you haven't painted the front half? And then you're going to bolt them together at the end? We knew we wanted to build EVs differently, and we decided how we wanted to build them. Then we got a huge set of engineering problems we had to go solve to make that work. The worst of these problems? Joining the front end, sealing, crash, strength, corrosion, dimensional accuracy, all those things. Doing those at the end is that front end joint is definitely the most difficult." Yes, much of this is catching up with state-of-the-art stuff for EVs, such as zonal architecture, where different functions are controlled in different parts of the car, which you can already see in the new Tesla Model Y and many China EVs. Similarly, large aluminum castings are already being used by Tesla and Chinese makers. However, if Ford has generally managed to build a car in three distinct modules, which are completely full and only then bolted together, that is a genuine first. Yes, Tesla talked about doing something like this back in 2023 when its unboxed EV manufacturing process, but it hasn't done it yet. In other words, Ford may have beaten Tesla to the punch here. The old dinosaur has turned into quite the velociraptor. Almost as impressive as Ford's new modular manufacturing is the number of people and sheer speed with which the company has achieved this undeniable win. What's really interesting is the size of the team the Skunkworks had compared to what if Ford had to do this, says Farley. "If we forced Ford to do it, it would have taken five times the people." "When we agreed to start the program 3 years ago, we hired Alan Clark. He went into a building, and it was one person. That's how the project started," says Field. Alan Clark, who worked for Field at Tesla, where he helped create the Model 3, worked on the Y, the Cybertruck, and more. "There's people in China now who probably have passed him, but at the time he had architected more electric vehicles than anyone in the world, so he was absolutely the right person to tap. And he's also a talent magnet. He's built the team really quickly, a world-class team. A lot of people who are super excited to move from a Rivian or a Tesla and build something for Ford." Farley thinks that Ford's new way of making EVs is the perfect weapon to take on the Chinese auto manufacturers, the ideal example of precisely how the West needs to compete. "You've got the BYD model, 700,000 employees, 200,000 powertrain engineers. How do you beat them?" asked Farley. "Turns out Doug and Alan and the team built a propulsion system that was like Apollo 13, managed down to the watt so that our battery could be so much smaller than BYD's. Their cost advantage on vertical integration on the battery is offset by innovations in the powertrain. We can't beat them on scale, we can't beat them on vertical integration, but we can beat them on innovation." And now, model backlash. OpenAI scrambles to update GPT-5 after users revolt. GPT-5 was touted as a major upgrade to ChatGPT. Not all users think that it's the case, posting threads like, Kill 4.0 isn't innovation, it's erasure, on Reddit. Written by Will Knight, posted 8/11/25 at 3 p.m. OpenAI's GPT-5 model was meant to be a world-changing upgrade to its wildly popular and precocious chatbot. But for some users, last Thursday's release felt more like a wrenching downgrade, with the new ChatGPT presenting a diluted personality and making surprisingly dumb mistakes. On Friday, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman took to X to say the company would keep the previous model, GPT-4.0, running for Plus users. A new feature designed to seamlessly switch between models depending on the complexity of the query had broken on Thursday, Altman said, and the result was GPT-5 seemed way dumber. He promised to implement fixes to improve GPT-5's performance and the overall user experience. Given the hype around GPT-5, some level of disappointment appears inevitable. When OpenAI introduced GPT-4 in March 2023, it stunned AI experts with its incredible abilities. GPT-5, pundits speculated, would surely be just as jaw-dropping. OpenAI touted the model as a significant upgrade, with PhD-level intelligence and virtuoso coding skills. A system to automatically route queries to different modules was meant to provide a smoother user experience. It could also save the company money by directing simple queries to cheaper models. Soon after GPT-5 dropped, however, a Reddit community dedicated to GPT filled with complaints. Many users mourned the loss of the old model. I've been trying GPT-5 for a few days now. Even after customizing instructions, it still doesn't feel the same. It's more technical, more generalized, and honestly feels emotionally distant, wrote one member of the community in a thread titled, Kill 4.0 isn't innovation, it's erasure. Sure, 5 is fine if you hate nuance and feeling things, another Reddit user wrote. Other threads complained of sluggish responses, hallucinations, and surprising errors. Altman promised to address these issues by doubling GPT-5 rate limits for ChatGPT Plus users, improving the system that switches between models, and letting users specify when they want to trigger a more ponderous and capable thinking mode. We will continue to work to get things stable, and we'll keep listening to feedback, the CEO wrote on X. As we mentioned, we expect some bumpiness as we roll out so many things at once, but it was a little more bumpy than we had hoped for. Errors posted on social media do not necessarily indicate that the new model is less capable than its predecessors. They maybe simply suggest the all-new model is tripped up by a different edge case than previous versions. OpenAI declined to comment specifically on why GPT-5 sometimes appears to make simple blunders. The backlash has sparked a fresh debate over the psychological attachment some users form with chatbots trained to push their emotional buttons. Some Reddit users dismissed complaints about GPT-5 as evidence of an unhealthy dependence on an AI companion. In March, OpenAI published research exploring the emotional bonds users form with its models. Shortly after, the company issued an update to GPT-4.0 after it became too sycophantic. It seems that GPT-5 is less sycophantic, more business, and less chatty, says Patty Mays, a professor at MIT who worked on the study. I personally think of that as a good thing because it also is what led to delusions, bias reinforcement, etc. But unfortunately, many users like a model that tells them that they are smart and amazing and confirms their opinions and beliefs, even if they are wrong. Altman indicated in another post on X that it is something the company wrestled with in building GPT-5. A lot of people effectively use ChatGPT as a sort of therapist or life coach, even if they wouldn't describe it that way, Altman wrote. He added that some users may be using ChatGPT in ways that help improve their lives, while others might be using unknowingly nudged away from their longer-term well-being. And now, book excerpt. The Rise of the U.S. Military's Clandestine Foreign War Apparatus. Seth Harp's new book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, goes deep into the forming of the Joint Special Operations Command and its origins in the aftermath of 9/11. By Seth Harp, posted 8/12/25 at 7 a.m. The 2020s are shaping up to be one of the most violent decades in modern history, with American-sponsored proxy conflicts and shadow wars smoldering all over the world, from Ukraine to Yemen to Gaza. The United States enables and prolongs these wars, not by sending troops to fight in them, but by trafficking arms to the belligerents, providing intelligence to its favored proxies, and using covert operations, especially assassinations, to shape geopolitical conditions. At the forefront of these clandestine U.S. military machinations is the Fort Bragg Base Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, which, despite its relative invisibility to the public, is far and away the most powerful organization in the military and one of the most influential institutions in the U.S. government. But it was not always this way. As I discuss in my new book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, the rise of JSOC does not date back to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, or the wars that the United States waged in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Twin Towers. Rather, the origins of JSOC's takeover from within are traceable to the darkest days of the Iraq War, about 5 years after 9/11, when things were going considerably worse for American war planners and foreign policy officials, and in a backlash that would lead to the election of President Barack Obama, the public was turning sharply against U.S. involvement in foreign wars. This excerpt tells part of that story. On just one day, in June 2006, the Associated Press reported that shootings and bombings killed 12 people in Baghdad. A suicide bomber killed 4 and wounded 27 at the funeral of a Shiite soldier. 7 bullet-riddled bodies were pulled from the Tigris River. 2 had been tortured to death, were fished out of the Euphrates, and police found the body of a teenage girl who had been raped and murdered in Kirkuk. Amid this horrible paroxysm of revenge killings, arguing Iraq's descent into outright civil war split among sectarian lines. President George W. Bush and his National Security Council pulled together a host of new advisors in an attempt to revise their failing strategy. It was at this juncture that a number of ambitious officials in the special operations community stepped up to offer a new path forward. The plan of action that they developed, which Bush's successor would adopt and expand in Afghanistan, forever transformed the American way of making war, and goes a long way toward explaining how Fort Bragg, North Carolina, even more than the CIA's headquarters at Langley, Virginia, came to be the United States National Nerve Center of invisible imperial power. Stanley McChrystal, then a 2-star major general, was the most important figure in this revolution in military affairs. McChrystal, a West Point graduate and the son of a distinguished general, had risen through the ranks in the 75th Ranger Regiment and was groomed for some of the military's most sensitive missions. Smart, shrewd, charismatic, and press-savvy, McChrystal came first to prominence as a Pentagon spokesman, and in 2003 was tapped to lead Black Ops at JSOC, which until then had been relegated to important but limited roles. Consistent with the emphasis laid on psychological operations in the Special Forces, the most important warfighting innovation that McChrystal developed while serving in this position was not primarily tactical or strategic, but ideological and mediatic. Although there were relatively few foreign fighters in Iraq, and most came from neighboring Syria, McChrystal was the primary proponent of the view, quick to spread among Washington policymakers, that the enemy was not a nationalist rebellion against outside occupation, but one node of a global conspiracy of America hating terrorists. To describe this nebulous and inherently malignant foe, McChrystal and his staff invented the term Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or AQI. At the top of this dubious organization, which they themselves had done more than anyone else to conjure into being, JSOC analysis placed the dopey Jordanian criminal Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a mysterious Bedouin boogeyman much hyped by deceitful Pentagon spooks in the run-up to the war, who may not have even been in Iraq at the time. To explain away the paucity of tangible contacts between insurgents in Iran and Osama bin Laden's organization, the remnants of which were now scattered around Pakistan and Yemen, McChrystal and his aides redefined Al-Qaeda as a concentric grouping of denaturalized franchises operating on a blind cell model. In his memoir, McChrystal admits with remarkable, if belated frankness, that JSOC produced intelligence assessments that inflated Al-Qaeda's role and problematically used AQI as a catch-all designation for any Sunni group that attacked Americans. This narrative, he acknowledges, was a way to sidestep the reality that most Iraqi insurgents were primarily motivated by earthly grievances, not Islamist ideology. There is no indication, however, that he shared these important caveats with President Bush, who seized upon the imaginary influx of foreign jihadists into Iraq as the after-the-fact vindication of his discredited case for war. By grossly exaggerating Zarqawi's importance, McChrystal and his deputy, Vice Admiral William McRaven, convinced the Bush administration that it was possible for the United States to kill its way to victory in Iraq through a massively stepped-up campaign of targeted assassinations. This was an essential precondition for the rise of JSOC. Another of the advisors whom Bush called upon to reformulate the war effort in late 2026 was Michael Vickers, the top Pentagon official in charge of the larger umbrella organization over JSOC, the Special Operations Command, or SOCOM, known by the comically unwieldy acronym ASDSO/LIC and IC, for Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations, Low Intensity Conflict, and Interdependent Capabilities. In his memoir, Vickers recalls how the Bush administration scrapped its existing playbook and instituted a new policy that put JSOC firmly in charge of the fight in Iraq. The plan involved a two-pronged approach, the public-facing aspect of which was a temporary buildup or surge of conventional forces, but the real escalation took place behind the scenes, as JSOC was quietly tasked with implementing a radically expanded campaign of mass assassinations, very similar to the Vietnam-era Phoenix program, which, in spite of the repugnance it had elicited from the public, was considered an excess by the Washington-dwelling national security set. Once limited to former regime officials and leaders of the insurgency, JSOC's hit list, euphemistically known as the Disposition Matrix or Joint Prioritized Effects List, grew exponentially to include anyone, however useful or peripheral, suspected of taking up arms against American occupiers. Vicks calls this covert war the hidden surge. From now on, Iraq would be a war of targeted killings, carried out clandestinely, almost always at night. Swollen with new infusions of money, personnel, equipment, and aircraft, JSOC became JSOC on steroids, a counter-terrorism killing machine capable of slaying recalcitrant Iraqis on a scale that both Vickers and McChrystal described as industrial. From about 10 a month at the start of the war, the number of night raids that JSOC carried out increased to 10 per day at the height of the surge. McChrystal called this relentless tempo the continuous targeting cycle. Fluent in McKinsey-style jargon like decision cycle, dynamic process, and nodal analysis, he was adept at spitting out pithy truisms such as, it takes a network to defeat a network, and a prolific coiner of acronyms like F3EAD, which stood for fix, find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze, and disseminate. Despite the ungainly initialism, the F3EAD cycle was not a complicated concept. It meant mentally tracking down a target, killing him and every adult man and teenage boy in the vicinity, seizing every piece of paper and electronic device found on their persons, and using these materials to come up with more names to add to the hit list, and then killing them too, sometimes just a few hours later. The hidden surge in which the Army component of JSOC, known as Delta Force, played the leading role was greatly enabled by the widespread adoption of cell phones in Iraq, a technological development that coincided with the first few years of American operations. JSOC's screen-filled headquarters at Camp Anaconda received an influx of personnel from the National Security Agency, who found it trivial to intercept unencrypted calls on Iraqis' burgeoning mobile networks and could easily transform cell phones into listening devices. Television and film depictions of the global war on terrorism often portray American operators and spies as able to speak the local languages, suavely lobbying savvy quotations from the Quran at their truculent Islamist antagonists, but in the starting admission with sobering implications. McChrystal states in his memoir that JSOC in Iraq War was hindered by an almost complete lack of Arabic skills within our force, suggesting that nearly all of those whom Delta Force killed were targeted not on the basis of the content of telephonic intercepts, but on pseudoscientific nodal analysis, tips from paid informants, and arbitrary guesswork. We were not death squads, McChrystal writes, but armed with NSA intercepts backed by newly developed Reaper drones and joined by fierce Kurdish mercenaries called Mohawks, that's exactly what JSOC became during the covert surge in Iraq, which lasted into 2008. The body count from Delta Force's killing spree and the proportion of Iraq's hundreds of thousands of war dead who were gunned down in JSOC's night raids will never be known because it wasn't recorded in the first place. That these events are lost to the historical and photographic record was by design. What Vickers dubs the hidden surge was a side of the Iraq War never intended to be seen by the public, who were fed images of conventional uniformed troops on patrol, but never any footage of the plainclothes men who did nearly all the nighttime wet work. From 2006 on, 90% or higher of insurgent deaths were from targeted offensive SOF operations, said a former Delta Force sergeant major who served in Iraq during the surge. Using an acronym that refers to special operations forces in general, going out night after night on purpose and getting in firefights with bad guys, that job fell to us. Instead of mounting patrols and reacting to fire like conventional infantry, Delta Force operations identified their targets from a distance in advance and took them by surprise, often making use of perfidious techniques such as disguising themselves as Iraqis, using wigs, brown face, and prosthetics. They posed as Red Cross personnel, United Nations inspectors, Western businessmen, or European diplomats. With the help of female support soldiers, they passed themselves off as husband and wife pairs, masquerading, for instance, as married schoolteachers who'd come to teach English to Iraqi kids. They even copied the enemy's tactics and blew up targets with roadside bombs. Among themselves, the bearded, long-haired operators called each other by their first names, eschewed division of rank, and dressed in a mishmash of civilian attire. When they did wear uniforms, the unit patches were purely fictitious, homegrown police badges, the seal of various states, Spartan helmets, Crusader shields, the Confederate battle flag, or jokey tabs that said things like Hatchet Force or F Al-Qaeda. No camera crews ever went on night raids with Delta Force. Their operations were not the subject of news documentaries, nor do we possess any oral histories, because silence is the unit's chief point of pride. But over time, these strictures inevitably loosen, if only a little. In recent years, many former special operators have gone on to podcasts to discuss their military careers in a certain Army Special Missions Unit or compartmented element. And once rare photos of JSOC operations have found their way onto social media, including images of Delta Force in Iraq under McChrystal's leadership. Several of my rotations to Iraq were composed of just my team and a small HQ element, a former Delta Force troop. Sergeant Major named Jesse Bocher wrote in an Instagram post dated February 28, 2022. While I had the full force of the U.S. government just a radio call away, there were very few of us on the ground getting dirty. Our small element was able to execute and refine the entire F-3 EAD cycle almost daily, with very little outside assistance. In the photo accompanying the post, Bocher, then in his mid-30s, sits at a table dressed in soiled civilian clothes. In back of him is a whiteboard. Much of the writing on it has been blacked out, but you can still read random words, including meeting, explosives, liaison, interrogation, and safe house. Taped on the wall behind the whiteboard is a grid of 55 mud shots of brown-skinned men. Almost all have been crossed out with an X. Another picture posted January 19, 2022, shows the rest of Bocher's team, a group of seven unkempt white men. It might look like a ragtag bunch of ruffians, but this crew were straight-up pipe hitters, Bocher wrote, using an obscure term considered a high compliment to the special operations community that derives from the concept of a soldier who is so fearless, daring, and addicted to war that he can be likened to a smoker of crack cocaine. The guys in front, Bocher wrote, referring to three fresh-faced, clean-shaven young men kneeling in the foreground, have killed more people than cancer. Excerpt adapted from The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and the Murder in the Special Forces by Seth Harp, published by arrangement with Viking. Copyright 2025 by Seth Harp. And now, Save the Shire. What does Palantir actually do? Palantir is often called a data broker, a data miner, or a giant database of personal information. In reality, it's none of these, but even former employees struggle to explain it. By Carolyn Haskins, posted 8/11/25 at 7 a.m. Palantir is arguably one of the most notorious corporations in contemporary America. Co-founded by libertarian tech billionaire Peter Thiel, the software firm's work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the U.S. Department of Defense, and the Israeli military has sparked numerous protests in multiple countries. Palantir has been so infamous for so long that for some people, its name has become a cultural shorthand for dystopian surveillance. But a number of former Palantir employees tell Wired they believe the public still largely misunderstands what the company actually does and how its software works. Some people think it's a data broker that buys information from private companies and resells it to the government. Others think it's a data miner, constantly scanning the internet for unique insights it can collect and market to customers. Still, others think it maintains a giant centralized database of information collected from all of its clients. In reality, Palantir does none of these things, but the misconceptions continue to persist. Palantir has tried to correct the record itself in a series of blog posts with titles like Palantir is not a data company, and Palantir is still not a data company. In the latter, Palantir explains that misconceptions can arise because our products are complicated. but nonetheless, it's absolutely possible to accurately describe them to people who are curious. The problem, however, is that even ex-employees struggle to provide a clear description of the company. It's really hard to explain what Palantir works on or what it does, says Linda Zia, who was an engineer at Palantir from 2022 to 2024. Even as someone who worked there, it's hard to figure out how do you give a cohesive explanation. Zia was one of 13 former Palantir staffers who signed an open letter published in May arguing that the company risked being complicit in authoritarianism by continuing to cooperate with the Trump administration. She and other former Palantir staffers who spoke to Wired for this story argue that, in order to grapple with Palantir and its role in the world, let alone hold the company accountable, you need to first understand what it really is. It's not that former employees literally don't know what Palantir is selling. In interviews with Wired, they spoke fluidly about how its software can connect and transform different kinds of data collected by government agencies and corporations. But when asked to, say, name its direct business competitors, two former Palantir employees who requested anonymity to speak freely about their experiences struggled to come up with anything. I still don't know how to answer the question, to be honest, says one. Juan Sebastian Pinto, who worked as a content strategist at Palantir and also signed the open letter, says it sells software to other businesses, a category commonly referred to in Silicon Valley as B2B SaaS. Another former staffer says Palantir provides really extravagant plumbing with data. Zia calls Foundry, one of Palantir's flagship software platforms, a collection of different applications that customers use to operationalize data. A fourth employee dubbed Foundry a supercharged filing cabinet. While all these descriptions are technically accurate, they could also apply to products from hundreds of other tech companies. So what sets Palantir apart? Part of the answer may lie in Palantir's marketing strategy. Pinto says he believes that the company, which recently began using the tagline, "software that dominates," has cultivated its mysterious public image on purpose. Unlike consumer-facing startups that need to clearly explain their products to everyday users, Palantir's main audience is sprawling government agencies and Fortune 500 companies. What it's ultimately selling them is not just software, but the idea of a seamless, almost magical solution to complex problems. To do that, Palantir often uses the language and aesthetics of warfare, painting itself as a powerful quasi-military intelligence partner. Palantir is here to disrupt and make the institutions we partner with the very best in the world, Palantir CEO Alexander Karp says in a February 2025 earnings call, and when it's necessary to scare the enemies and on occasion kill them. Palantir sends its employees to work inside client organizations, essentially as consultants, helping to customize their data pipelines, troubleshoot problems, and fix bugs. It calls these workers forward-deployed software engineers, a term that appears to be inspired by the concept of forward-deployed troops, who are stationed in adversarial regions to deter nearby enemies from attacking. A former Palantir employee tells Wired that the company also has code words for certain job titles, like Delta for a forward-deployed engineer, and Echo for Palantir's version of a product manager, which they say are sourced from North Atlantic Treaty Organization's phonetic alphabet of code words meant for use over military radio. A different former employee tells Wired that Palantir staffers will often use the military term FYSA, or for your situational awareness, instead of FYI. Many Palantir emails, they say, also begin with bluff, BLUF, or bottom line up front, followed by a short summary of key details or events. It's essentially the military equivalent of TLDR, or too long, didn't read. The ex-staffer says this jargon can be traced back to Palantir's first clients, which included U.S. intelligence and military agencies. But arguably, Palantir's most recognizable jargon is borrowed from the Lord of the Rings universe. The company's name is a reference to J.R.R. Tolkien's Palantir magical stones that can be used to communicate, see faraway places, and observe moments from the past and future. Palantir's employees are also sometimes called hobbits. According to one former employee, a common internal motto in Palantir's early days was "Save the Shire," a reference to the hobbit homeland, which they say was a rallying cry that reflected the company's ethos at the time. "It was all about save the Shire and do good for the warfighters," the ex-staffer says. "It was all about, really, we're going in and solving hard problems." In response to a detailed request for comment from Wired, Palantir spokesperson Lisa Gordon said in a statement that the company is proud to support the U.S. government, especially our warfighters, and that it has never wavered from its founding mission to support the West and empower the world's most important institutions. Gordon added that the open letter criticizing Palantir was only signed by a small portion of the company's approximately 8,000 employees and alumni. Dawn of big data. Underneath the jargon in marketing, Palantir sells tools that its customers, corporations, nonprofits, government agencies use to sort through data. What makes Palantir different from other tech companies is the scale and scope of its products. Its pitch to potential customers is that they can buy one system and use it to replace perhaps a dozen other dashboards and programs, according to a 2022 analysis of Palantir's offerings published by blogger and data engineer Ben Rogojan. Crucially, Palantir doesn't reorganize a company's bins and pipes, so to speak, meaning it doesn't change how data is collected or how it moves through the guts of an organization. Instead, its software sits on top of a customer's messy systems and allows them to integrate and analyze data without needing to fix the underlying architecture. In some ways, it's a technical band-aid. In theory, this makes Palantir particularly well-suited for government agencies that may use state-of-the-art software cobbled together when programming languages dated back to the 1960s. Palantir began gaining steam in the 2010s, a decade when corporate business discourse was dominated by the rise of big data. Hundreds of tech startups popped up promising to disrupt the market by leveraging information that was now readily available thanks to smartphones and internet-connected sensors, including everything from global shipping patterns to the social media habits of college students. The hype around big data put pressure on companies, especially legacy brands without sophisticated technical know-how to upgrade their software, or else risk looking like dinosaurs to their customers and investors. But it's not exactly easy or cheap to upgrade computer systems that may date back years or even decades. Rather than tearing everything down and building anew, companies may want a solution designed to be slapped on top of what they already have. That's where Palantir comes in. Palantir software is designed with non-technical users in mind. Rather than relying on specialized technical teams to parse and analyze data, Palantir allows people across an organization to get insights, sometimes without writing a single line of code. All they need to do is log into one of Palantir's two primary platforms, Foundry for commercial users or Gotham for law enforcement and government users. The sales pitch. Foundry focuses on helping businesses use data to do things like manage inventory, monitor factory lines, and track orders. Gotham, meanwhile, is an investigative tool specifically for police and government clients designed to connect people, places, and events of interest to law enforcement. There's also Apollo, which is like a control panel for shipping automatic software updates to Foundry or Gotham. And the artificial intelligence platform, a suite of AI-powered tools that can be integrated into Gotham or Foundry. Foundry and Gotham are similar. both ingest data and give people a neat platform to work with it. The main difference between them is what data they're ingesting. Gotham takes any data that government or law enforcement customers may have, including things like crime reports, booking logs, or information they collected by subpoenaing a social media company. Gotham then extracts every person, place, and detail that might be relevant. Customers need to already have the data they want to work with. Palantir itself does not provide any. A former Palantir staffer who has used Gotham says that in just a few minutes, law enforcement's official or government analysis can map out who may be in a person's network and see documents that link them together. They can also centralize everything an agency knows about a person in one place, including their eye color from their driver's license or their license plate from a traffic ticket, making it easy to build a detailed intelligence report. They can also use Gotham to search for a person based on a characteristic, like their immigration status, what state they live in, or whether they have any tattoos. The sales pitch for tools like Foundry and Gotham is that they can transcend all the challenges associated with storing and structuring data and naturally bring investigations and business decision makers to the correct solution. With an objectively superior technology, the thinking goes, the best possible outcomes will follow. A version of this logic pervades the internal culture at Palantir. When asked what distinguishes it from other tech companies, former employees consistently mentioned its flat staffing structure. Engineers can literally move to more prestigious or challenging projects if they prove worthy based on their skills and connections. One former staffer tells Wired that this made the company feel like a meritocracy where the best people and the best ideas naturally rise to the top. Some former employees say that Palantir's mediocratic culture helped cultivate a sense of loyalty among staff, but they also believe that this can make it difficult to speak out against the company or its business decisions. Gordon said that Palantir prides itself on a culture of fierce internal dialogue and disagreement on difficult issues related to our work. During her time at Palantir, Shia says she worked exclusively with private businesses using Foundry. However, she felt a nagging discomfort about the military work happening in other parts of the organization. I did the thing that I think a lot of people do, Sia says, which is I just didn't engage with it. Since leaving Palantir, Pinto says he spent a lot of time reflecting on the company's ability to parse and connect vast amounts of data. He's now deeply worried that an authoritarian state could use this power to tell any narrative they want about, say, immigrants or dissidents it may be seeking to arrest or deport. He says that software like Palantir's doesn't eliminate human bias. People are the ones that choose how to work with the data, what questions to ask about it, and what conclusions to draw. Their choices could have positive outcomes like ensuring enough COVID-19 vaccines are delivered to vulnerable areas. They could also have devastating ones like launching a deadly strike or deporting someone. In some ways, Palantir can be seen as an amplifier of other people's intentions and biases. It helps them make ever more precise and intentional decisions, for better or for worse. But this may not always be obvious to Palantir's users. They may only experience a sophisticated platform, sold to them using the vocabulary of warfare and hegemony. It may feel as if objective conclusions are flowing naturally from the data. When Gotham users connect disparate pieces of information about a person, it could seem like they are reading their whole life story rather than just a slice of it. It's a really powerful tool, said one former Palantir employee, and when it's in the wrong hands, it can be really dangerous. And I think people should really be scared about it. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Sam Cantrell with Wired. And I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.